Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield, brought to you by me, Sean Delaney. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous programmes on seandelaney.com/podcasts. This week and next week on the programme, I focus on teaching the visual arts in the company of one of the foremost visual arts educators in Ireland, Dr. Michael Fannery from the Merino Institute of Education. We met up to mark the launch of a new master's course in the visual arts offered by the Merino Institute of Education and directed by Michael Flannery. The degree course is accredited by Trinity College Dublin. Michael Flannery is a qualified primary school teacher who has been working as a teacher educator in the visual arts for almost 2 decades. He received his PhD from the National College of Art and Design in 2010. His research interests include visual arts inquiry, imagination and creativity, integrated arts and visual arts integration, and creative technologies and visual arts. He has a rich and broad knowledge of the visual arts, and over the course of our interview we covered many topics related to teaching the visual arts, especially in the primary school. So I hope you can sit back, relax and enjoy the interview. I began the conversation by asking Michael to tell me how he became interested in the visual arts and subsequently in visual arts education.
When I think about that, Sean, I suppose you go back into your childhood, and I remember being affirmed many times by many teachers in relation to my ability to draw, if you like. And my mother kept all of my infant copybooks, and it was an interesting exercise to go back in time and to see. You could obviously see that I was interested in drawing. But I have other memories, say, for example, of collecting stones and painting stones to use them as doorstops. And I also then was really interested in oddments, such as bits of wood and putting them together, say, for example, to make particular craft or maybe kind of sculptural objects. Both my parents, I would identify them as being creative, because my dad is interested in wood turning. He also was interested in a little bit of painting. And my mother then was more kind of craft orientated in terms of embroidery and knitting and applique and that sort of thing. So I think probably the arts was part of our household, but in a very informal way.
And the affirmation of teachers over the years made a difference.
I think so, yeah, because I know probably if I was to say where my strengths were, you know, I hadn't found my sport, shall we say, at that period of time. I come from Kilkenny, really, so hurling didn't come naturally to me. So I think teachers identified then that I had this artistic leaning. I remember one teacher, for example, complimenting me then on my crib construction and complimenting me on
crib,
my...
A Christmas crib.
A Christmas crib, yes. And I do remember then another primary school teacher then who afforded me the opportunity to get involved in illustration then for a school magazine. So I'd be very complimentary about my teachers in primary school then in terms of how they nurtured my creativity, if you like, in the area of visual arts.
And that continued then when you became a teacher, you became interested particularly in visual arts education.
Yeah, I think when it came to my career aspirations, there was a part of me that would have liked to have maybe gone to art college, but I daren't to have approached my parents with the idea then of actually getting them to fund me to go to art college. So I decided to go down the teaching route, if you like. But when I went to St. Patrick's College, obviously I was afforded the opportunity then to study visual arts as part of an elective as well as curriculum visual arts. And of course, that was really of interest to me because we were afforded the opportunity to actually to go to galleries as well and also then to work on particular pieces around a theme and then to group appraise each other's work. And I found that a really lovely experience. I was also interested at one point in time in going back to study architecture, and I do think that I have a kind of leaning towards architectural kind of formalist pieces of work as well, but I didn't pursue that. But I find actually that some of the things that attract me to architecture then I can find within visual arts, such as like form and structure and pattern and rhythm and tone and texture. They all reside within the world of visual arts.
And if we take that expression, to be good at art, what does that mean?
To be good at something really means that you've reached a level of success maybe in comparison to maybe other people. And I suppose in terms of maybe being successful at visual art, I think ultimately means that you are successful in affecting the viewer in some shape or form. So in other words, you're affecting them emotionally or viscerally, if you like, then in terms of art. You're getting them to think about a topic or a concept through your art mode. To be good at art, I think really is that you've fostered the ability then to be persistent with your art form as well. That in other words, that you've spent time working in your particular choice of media, if you like, and you've experimented, you've taken risks, you've learned from those risks, you started to hone a craft, you developed a skill. To be good at art, I think, also means that you're not overly fearful of failure. In other words, then you can appreciate then that you're learning from the mistakes, and mistakes is part of your practice. And the more mistakes that you make, then the more improvements you make to your actual ability then to kind of create work. And I think that culminates then in more successful pieces then, which culminates then in being identified as a person that is good at art. I think it would be true to say that artists then have this capacity to steal as well, to steal ideas. And what I mean by that is not in the sense of plagiarism, but the idea then of stealing ideas from the world around you in terms of what you see and what you hear and what you experience, looking at other works of art then and taking ideas from that and making them your own. So just like a writer, for example, then will improve their ability to write through reading, an artist might improve their ability to make works of art by looking and responding to works around them, learning from other artists, if that makes sense. I think to be good at art as well, then you also probably have to be perceived to be original, maybe, in how you perceive particular topics that you want to explore through particular media, or that you're original in terms of how you explore the properties and the possibilities of the media itself. So it might be, for example, how you explore maybe the properties of paint media. It could be you're exploring different impasto effects using textures, or it could be your exploration of color, or it could be your exploration of mixed media, adding other media to paint, that you're quite innovative and original in terms of how you explore the media itself. And the other thing I would say then, in terms of being good at art, I think artists know when to stop as well. So in other words, they're tuned into, the phrase is somatic knowledge, the ability to know when something is right. And this would also be applicable maybe to a writer that's writing literature, for example, or a poet who's writing a poem. They don't overdo something. They know when to stop. There's a sense of rightness about it as well. I think artists who are good at art know how far to progress a piece of work and know when to stop it as well.
That's an interesting one, that last one, because it's one I've often noticed myself with children in school. They reach a certain stage in a picture and maybe it's looking really good, and then they go a little bit too far and it doesn't look quite as good at the end as it did earlier.
Well, the thing about that, I suppose, is that in some ways that is your sense of taste, that you feel then that the child is overworking it. And to a degree, you're right. They're learning, but they're learning through mistakes. So like, if we look at maybe a child who's in the infant classes, they're really interested in the properties and the possibilities of paint. They're mixing it, and they're mixing it so much that suddenly they're resulting in tertiary browns and greys. And you might say that's such a pity then that they've lost the colour that they originally had. But I think children have to go through that stage, as adults we do as well. We have to go through that stage. We're testing basically the potential of the material that we're working with, you know. So it's the same with construction. We might be sort of stacking and stacking and stacking until it collapses, shall we say. We have the tendency maybe to put excess ink when we're printmaking or something. We might put an excess motif into a piece of creative textile. So that overdoing something is probably a natural learning curve, and at some point in time they'll refrain from doing that.
And those things that you said about being good at art, like having an impact on a viewer, or being original, or experimenting, to what extent does that apply to being good at art, say, in primary school?
Well, I think originality is something that we really want to encourage children to be, really. The curriculum emphasises that the child should be the designer of their own work. So it really behoves the teacher, when they're designing a lesson plan, to design it in a manner that there might be a shared stimulus, such as maybe a work of art or a poem, or maybe it's a line from a poem, maybe it's a newspaper heading, or maybe it's a particular topic that comes from a different subject area. But it should be open-ended in the sense that the children can decide what decisions they will make then in terms of the content that's what they actually maybe depict or print or draw or construct, but also how they go about doing it. In other words, the techniques that they might incorporate into it as well. But you might decide that the stimulus per lesson might be a particular technique, a technique that you would like to demonstrate to the children. I'm just thinking of a wax resist technique. And then you will leave it open for the children to explore a particular theme or topic of their choosing using that particular technique. And then when you're closing the lesson, you can compare and contrast then how they've used that technique in various ways, in terms of the colours that they've chosen, but also in terms of maybe the topic or the theme that they've explored. So originality is a key thing that you're looking for, and it's a measure really of quality good arts practice.
Why should children learn art? What does it contribute to their education?
Well, There are many books, I suppose, written about the value of the arts. The one thing that I would say that if you look back in time, it is an innate drive, I think, within the human condition then to express him or herself, if you like. And one of the modes that we express ourselves is through the visual mode. We also express ourselves then through dance, through music, through drama, through the language arts. But visual art is one that we can see very tangibly then. If we look back through time, we can see it on manuscripts, we can see it on historical artifacts. So the value that visual arts, and one of the values that it has, is this tangible, visceral, visual, textural outcome that in many ways represents then a particular thought or a particular imagining by the child. So it's lovely to see your work. The other thing I'd say is it is an agency for imagination, it's an agency for expression, and it's an agency for creativity. But that could be said of any kind of arts area as well. But apart from that, the visual arts, it's an opportunity to develop empathy as well, because often when you're looking at works of other art, often they have to do with a whole extreme of emotions, and not necessarily happiness, but there's sadness. Say, for example, there's paintings and works of art about conflict, about romance, about, you know, desolation. There's all sorts of themes that are addressed through visual art, and through looking and responding then you can develop empathy towards the topic in terms of how it's expressed. The other thing that visual arts is said to be good for is affording children the opportunity to encounter ambiguity. So we live in a world, for example, then, where advertisements then are very specific and very clear and very unambiguous about the message that they want to portray. And they do so very quickly within the period like of a couple of seconds. So it could be an advertisement on a billboard or between in a commercial, between a program, or it could be the flicking of a magazine. But visual art isn't so obvious. So often you have to spend time looking at a sculpture, looking at a print, looking at a piece of creative textile, and you have to spend time with it to discern a particular meaning from the work. And often then the meaning is derived, in, like, not so obviously, but from the detail or the nuance or the subtlety. And what's lovely about a work of art is that there's no one set meaning. There might be a specific artist's intent, but how viewers view the work might be different to what the artist intended. Especially like when we look at older work of art, we're looking at it through 21st century eyes. So how we, the meaning that we glean from work might be very different from the audience who first encountered the work. And also, you know, how you view work can be different based on maybe your experiences of life, your age and stage, your gender, your culture. So the meaning that you derive from a piece of work can be very different. And that's another thing that visual arts then teaches, is that the value of learning from other people's perspectives. So looking and responding to works of art then affords children the opportunity to appreciate then that there's multiple perspectives, you know, that not everybody thinks the same or sees the same or, you know, appraises the same.
I'm even particularly interested there in what you said about the difference in advertising and art, that advertising you can take it in, yeah, in a split second, whereas art needs a bit of time. And I just know myself, very often I don't give the kind of time to a piece of art that it may deserve, and maybe someone might point out something to me, oh, did you notice such a thing, and then I'll notice it. But do you find today that people are more impatient with artwork and in having the time to engage with it?
Well, we're kind of in an age and stage at the moment where we're supposed to be more mindful, isn't that right? And we're supposed to eat more slowly and, you know, and you know, just take time. But the same thing could be said then of works of art. Often when we head to a gallery, then we've got an agenda straight away. We want to see maybe sort of like 20 particular paintings that we've seen in magazines or we've seen in art books, and we're charging around all the different gallery spaces to try and find them. I think there was some research done to say that the average person spends no more than 6 seconds in front of a painting, and then they move on. Whereas really, I would say when you're going to a gallery, be a little more selective and allow yourself the opportunity to sort of absorb what is in front of you and go back and revisit it at different times, not on that particular day, but at different times during the year. Bring somebody with you so that you can have a discussion about it. Read some contextual information about the piece. Now, while the work of art has a value in its own right, if you like, that in other words, the meaning you derive from it is perfectly legitimate, I find a right that a little bit of contextual analysis or a little bit of contextual reading about the piece then enhances your understanding of the work, especially if it's avant-garde or contemporary and you haven't encountered that particular work before, you know. So some artists are not striving for realism, you know, they're striving for something else. If you want to understand maybe like you know, the principles of Cubism or the leanings or the emphases of Surrealism, for example, or, you know, what is the motivation or the intention behind maybe, you know, abstract expressionism. By doing a little bit of reading, a little bit of research, you're better able then to appraise the work, but also then to pass judgment on it as to whether you feel it's a good piece of work by the artist or not.
What are the strands of the art curriculum, the visual arts curriculum?
Well, the current strand in the current primary school curriculum, they're orientated around six media strands. So drawing, paint and colour, print, clay, construction and fabric and fibre. But, you know, as we know, the world of visual arts then is constantly evolving. So, you know, digital media, you know, there's the incorporation, then multimodal responses. The Irish Museum of Modern Art actually have a small little booklet whereby they have added on another strand, which is contemporary media. And I think that is something that possibly we should embrace a little bit more in primary school and secondary level, is a kind of an appreciation, really, that visual art is constantly kind of expanding. And that's what's very different between visual art and science. Generally speaking, then, as new technology comes in the world of science, we chuck out the old technology. But in the world of visual arts, and it's something that we can learn from the arts, is just because new emerging art forms come into being, that doesn't mean that we throw out the old. So in other words, we still appreciate Impressionism or Abstract Expressionism. We still appreciate, for example, you know, Aboriginal Dreamtime dot paintings. We still have an appreciation then for primitive artwork that's on prehistoric artwork, if you like, on caves. We don't throw out anything. As visual art then grows and develops, we embrace it all.
So teachers know what the strands of the curriculum are. Where can they get ideas for art lessons from?
I would say, really, there's ideas can be found everywhere, and there's no better magpie than a primary school teacher in terms of taking things that appeal for them. And I would say, really, that ideas can be taken anywhere, so it can be taken from any subject area. So, like, certainly there are four suggested practical starting points for visual arts. One is materials and tools. And what that really means is that looking at bric-a-brac material, they themselves, through their properties and possibilities, would conjure up ideas as to what you could make from them. So by encouraging children to bring in bric-a-brac material for printmaking or bric-a-brac material for construction or for fabric and fibre, the material themselves can be a wonderful source for ideation, really. The second area then is observation and curiosity then. And what that really means is affording the children the opportunity to go outside, to look around, to look up close, to look far away, to look up, to look down, to engage with nature, to engage with the urban environment, to engage with buildings. And these can be lovely sources of inspiration as well. The other area, of course, is the realm of the imagination then, entering the world of the surreal. Our dreamscapes, our imagination, if you like, is a wonderful source of ideation, really, for children.
Ideation, what does that word mean?
Well, ideation, I suppose, is just, what it means is the idea to conjure up an idea, really. The idea, it's the starting point in before creation. Generally speaking, I look at visual art in terms of ideation, creation, and then validation. And evaluation might be another stage as well. So ideation is the idea of coming up with a kind of an idea or a concept that you want to pursue. The creation stage then is where you're manifesting it then through a particular art form. The validation stage is, I suppose, where you put it up on a wall or you critique it or you have it on display. And then the evaluation stage is where you look at it yourself and you self-evaluate then how well you've done, what other decisions you could have made, whether it is finished, is it underdeveloped, what you would do if you were to do it differently, what's the next step. So that would be part of that. But going back then to the other starting point in terms of using the work of another artist as a springboard for imagination. So as I said previously then, to become a better writer, you need to read different genres, read different styles. The same would apply to art making. Teachers then should really expose children as much as possible to the diversity of art that is out there. And they themselves don't have to be an expert about it. But just to be mindful then, are they showing artwork from a particular, say, art movement to the neglect of the others? Are they showing artwork from Western artwork as opposed to other cultural groupings? We find that there probably is less artwork shown by female artists as opposed to male artists. So that's something that you could, is there a different perspective then that we can glean then from, you know, contemporary and past female artists? And also then artists then of various ages. So artists then, you know, artists don't retire really, they continue right on until, you know, until they, in the end, really, essentially. An example of that might be Henri Matisse. Henri Matisse would have explored paint, but as he got older then and couldn't manipulate the paintbrush as much, he then resorted then to collage and large-scale work, and then he had assistants helping him, and he did large-scale work using collage and paper cutouts and stuff like that. So his practice then evolved as he aged, as he got older. So, and we appreciate all of his work.
And when a teacher is working with either children or teenagers on art, what kind of differences might they see among children in a class?
Well, I suppose everybody brings something different to the classroom in terms of their experience, and everybody's imagination is different, really. So by having open-ended lesson plans, you're more likely then to see and to celebrate that difference in terms of approach. But just there are recognised, say, as theories, you know, that have unpacked maybe stages of development, starting off with the pre-scribbling, you know, the scribbling stage, going into the pre-schematic, at the schematic stage, dawning realism, if you like. Dawning realism is a stage where, by children maybe in fifth and sixth class, what they find is that they are no longer happy with their style of drawing. They feel that they cannot represent the world in all its complexity using their schema, which is a set of symbols. They're suddenly aware then of perspective, they're aware of shade and dark, they're aware of three-dimensionality then, and so they want to be able to portray the world with sort of this dawning realism. And often that's where confidence then is knocked, because they need to be given a skill set, if you like, and given experiences and
techniques,
yeah, really. But the best way, and I think it was the old adage, I think, that I heard was that in the best way I can improve your ability to draw is really to improve your ability to look. So in other words, if you decided to do a still life with a group of children, and we did it very recently on a school, a kind of a school links project, where we explored a still life based on the pineapple. And another thing that the visual arts does is that it makes the ordinary very extraordinary through the depiction of it. So we explored the pineapple then in terms of its shape, its texture, its colour, its pattern. And we explored it then using paper construction, using drawing, using paint and using print. And by the end of that journey, you could see that they were able to capture the essence, the likeness of the pineapple in terms of its texture, its shape and its colour as a consequence of repeated activities in different media. And if we had just asked them to do a still life drawing from the onset, we really wouldn't have got the level of skill that we got as a consequence of exploring construction, print, paint, and then drawing at the very end. So their still life would be far superior as a consequence of attentive looking at the pineapple from using the visual elements, but also in terms of its measurements, you know, repeated exercises.
Sometimes visual arts is used in primary school to mark special occasions that occur during the year, like Mother's Day cards or St. Patrick's Day badges. What's your view of such art activities?
Well, I normally refer to a guy called Barnes in relation to that, and he would say that really, when it comes to the use of templates then, such as the production of shamrocks for St. Patrick's Day, or like key motifs and symbols then that we associate with religious festivals or cultural festivals or significant events such as Christmas or Easter, he kind of says that at that point in time, you know, it happens in schools, but for people to really appreciate that, really, it's not a good example then of quality arts, visual arts practice. So I suppose what we would say is that when it comes to feasts and festivals, the question that you might ask then is that, how do you best celebrate that festival? And not to neglect the other arts areas, such as dance, drama, poetry, the language arts or music. They might be actually able to celebrate the feast and festival in a very meaningful manner. The thing about the reason why they use visual arts is that you can decorate corridors, you can decorate and you can celebrate an event then very tangibly along the corridors. But often what you would find then really is the use of, you know, deus ex templates, whereby it really limits the creative choice making of children. So what I would say is just try and be as open-ended as possible. So if it comes to Mothering Day, where you're trying to celebrate somebody significant in your life who mothers you, whether that's a female, a male, a grandmother, an aunt, a neighbour, somebody then that looks after you in this motherly way, what you might decide to do is unpack the qualities of mothering. You know, what are they? What are the caring dispositions? What are the caring actions? What are the feelings and the emotions that children feel when they are mothers? And then choose one of them as the starting point then for your open-ended art activity. Another approach would be to take something which is left of center. So you might decide that you would do maybe a floral still life activity, and you simply kind of roll it up, if you like, with a little bit of ribbon, pop a few chocolates in it, and bring it home. So in other words, you're just addressing the event of Mother's Day, but you're doing it by celebrating flowers and different types of flowers, and you're looking at still life, and it doesn't impact on the quality of the visual arts program per se.
How should a teacher assess children's progress in visual arts? Or should assessment be part of visual arts even?
Well, that's probably one of the misconceptions about visual art or any of the arts areas. And it's an argument often that puts the arts in the periphery of kind of mainstream education. The idea then that art isn't accessible, or that you shouldn't assess visual arts. But no, there is assessment criteria, and art should be assessed. And children should be self-assessing their own development in any form of learning. And so it applies then to visual arts. And you are asking yourself, number one, I think the area that you want is disposition towards the activity. And so a teacher might stand back and observe children's disposition towards the activity. And if children have a negative disposition towards a particular activity, they need to ask themselves why that is the case. And maybe it has to do with the pitch. Maybe it's the fact that, you know, they found the technique a little difficult, that maybe it should have been demonstrated a little bit more. Maybe they don't like that particular media. Maybe there should be some differentiation in terms of their choice of media. So disposition towards the activity is a key criterion for assessment, because we want all children to enjoy visual art, to feel that they are creative, to find the media that they like to express themselves the most, to feel confident to go into a gallery then to appraise a work of art, to appreciate then the necessity of visual arts within our lives. So that's just one area. The second area would be expressive abilities and skills, and that's divided into two sections. One is the capacity for the child to be able to express their thoughts, their feelings and their emotions as they look at a work of art and to be affected by works of art. And then on the other hand, then it's their capacity to be able to express their thoughts, their dreams, their imaginations, their feelings through visual art, whether it is print or paint or construction. The other area that we assess visual arts is called perceptual awareness. It has to do really with be able to, maybe the visual elements, for the child to be able to appreciate what line can do. So like line can create the illusion of depth, it can create the illusion of movement, you know, shape. When you repeat shape, you create pattern. Pattern can create rhythm within a piece of work. Colour can be used, to convey emotion. It can be used to convey perspective. Colour can energise a piece. It can create harmony. It can create disharmony. So to assess the child's capacity to use the visual elements in creative ways to convey meaning or to convey a particular mood, if you like. So visual arts can be assessed like any other subject area.
And that summary of assessment of children's work in the visual arts from Dr. Michael Flannery brings this week's Inside Education to a close. Michael Flannery is the course director for the new master's degree course in visual arts education taught fully in the Merino Institute of Education and accredited by Trinity College Dublin. My own book, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available for purchase online, or you can ask your local library to order it. Remember, you can listen to hundreds of podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Have a great week.